Robin Young, it's here and now. In a few moments, dire water shortages, bankrupt baby boomers, but also the millennials, one of the most optimistic generations in a long while. We'll look into the future with demographer Andrew Zolli. But first, returning from his warm reception in Albania and Bulgaria, a cold front awaits President Bush tonight. The president is due back from his European trip at around the same time that Senate Democrats have scheduled a no-confidence vote on his Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Democrats and even a few Republicans say it's time for Gonzalez to step aside. They say he hasn't been forthcoming on his involvement in the firing of several U.S. attorneys. Critics say the attorneys were dismissed for political reasons, but other critics are saying today's vote is also political. Asked about the no-confidence vote earlier when he was in Bulgaria, President Bush said the non-binding resolution will have no bearing on whether Gonzalez stays or goes.
I ascribe this lengthy series of the news stories and hearings is political.
Well, Rick Klein is senior political reporter for ABC News. He writes the note for the network's website. He joins us from Washington. Rick, you just heard the president calls the Gonzalez vote just politics. What do you think?
Well, he's going to ignore it no matter what it says. It's a non-binding vote on no confidence, and it does appear that Democrats won't even have the 60 votes they'll need to actually proceed to the vote. So it is a purely political maneuvering that's going on right now, and that's why the president feels like he is free to ignore it. The big question, though, will be how many Republicans jump ship on this and vote with the Democrats against Alberto Gonzalez.
Well, and staying with the politics, Democrats are saying it's about time for senators to go on record. Five Republicans have called outright for Gonzalez's dismissal. But, you know, are Republicans, you know, voting today on the ability to ask the question, or are they going to vote on Gonzalez?
Well, those who vote against the motion today will say it's on the ability to ask the question. They say, well, this is just partisan politics to even bring such a question to the Senate floor. So that's what they're voting against. But Democrats figure, look, there have been a lot of people who've criticized Alberto Gonzalez, Democrats and Republicans. Let's put everyone on record, because this is something that senators who are up for re-election next year may have to answer for, and just get everyone on the record and saying where they feel on Alberto Gonzalez. And there may be some surprises in terms of who feels that Alberto Gonzalez should be leaving the Justice Department.
Well, I was going to ask you if you think that there might be Republicans who, you know, abandon the president on this issue, and then maybe if the thinking is that, you know, as there's more and more concern about the Iraq war, is this part of a push by Democrats to make Republicans speak out on other issues as well?
Well, they certainly want to make that happen as much as possible. They've got a whole series of Iraq votes that they're going to tee up throughout the summer. And really, Republicans have told the White House in no uncertain terms that September is about as far as they can go in pursuing the current strategy without seeing some real success. So the White House is feeling the heat, and I think all of this is against the backdrop of him wanting to revive the immigration bill. He arrives back in the United States this evening, and he'll get down to business tomorrow visiting Capitol Hill to try to lobby Republican senators to drop their objections to the immigration bill. It's a key moment, I think, for a president who is struggling to maintain some relevance in the last 18 months he's gotten office.
And he comes back to try to do this, to try to revive this stalled, some say dead, bill. After this reception in Albania, just your thoughts on that.
Well, my first thought was I haven't seen anything like that greet the president since the 2004 campaign, when they would pack these events with GOP loyalists. And it's got to feel good for a president who's rarely gets that kind of reception in his own country, let alone in Europe, where a lot of people are very angry at his tenure in office. So it's got to give him a little bit of a spring in his step, maybe help him get over that stomach ailment that slowed him down late last week.
Well, in a spring, in just a few seconds, we have a spring he might need, as you say, this is really the president's last chance to push through a major domestic initiative with his work on the immigration bill.
I think so. I think if he can't get it done with this, where Democrats in Congress are on the same side as he is, then there's very little he can do either domestically or in foreign policy with a Congress that's going to be opposed to him. So this is the big issue.
It.
He knows it, and he knows it has to happen.
Rick Klein, who writes the note for the ABC News website. You can link to it by going to ours. Rick, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, looking ahead, really ahead. The 21st century's largest city is going to be in China. and it hasn't even been built yet. By 2030, more than 1 in 3 people will not have enough water to drink. And years after baby boomers retire, they're going to run out of money and move back with their kids. This is futurist Andrew Zolli's view of the world. As founder of Z Partners, he uses demographic information to advise companies on how to stay a step ahead of changes coming in the next 20, 50, 100 years. For example, demographic data tells him that for the first time in history, U.S. society will resemble not a pyramid, but an hourglass, with the largest number of old people in the U.S. ever, as baby boomers age, they're at the top, and the largest group of young people ever. They're known as the millennials. They'll be at the bottom, and a skinny middle section will hold the Gen Xers. An hourglass. So, Andrew, what does this hourglass society tell you about the future of the planet?
When you have a lot of older people and a lot of younger people, the general demographic principle is the older you are, the greener you are, because the more ecologically and conscientious your mindsets are, because the older you are, the closer you get to death, the more you think about your legacy and the world you leave behind. At the same time, the other truth is the younger you are, the greener you are, because the younger you are, the more you can afford your idealism. The people at the top end are going to have an enormous amount of discretionary income. There's a lot of money because we earn and save more money as we get older. So a lot of the income gets concentrated at the top. And you've got a young group of people who have more technologies at their disposal than ever before. The millennials are going to be awash in technologies for connecting, for building social movements. They're already doing it. If anyone who's watched MySpace or Facebook or any of those things, this is already the most digitally connected generation. But they're going to use those kinds of tools in combination with a generation that is not one generation above them, but two, the boomers. And the general rule is that generational affiliation skips a generation. So you always relate more to your grandparents than to your parents. And the connection between these older folks and these younger folks is going to be catalytic for changing the political, technological, and economic framework of the United States in about 20 years.
But you mentioned that the boomers are going to be awash in money. But you've also said that the boomers are going to run out of money because they didn't save enough and that they're going to move back with their kids.
That's a very good catch because, in fact, actually, whenever you get a big shift in a society, you always create trends and counter-trends. So some of the boomers, upon retirement, they are going to just transform their lives. They're going to be fairly wealthy. I mean, a lot of these people are going to disappear in a cloud of RV smoke and never be seen again. They're just going to circle the earth forever. And more power to them. Because some of their compatriots, because of historically low and, in fact, now negative savings rates in the United States, are not going to be able to afford to retire. Because there aren't as many younger people to compete for their jobs, many companies are going to want them to stay on the job even longer. So for a whole segment of boomers, we're going to see the end of retirement as we know it. So it's a real split. Now, one of the things that's fascinating about this is what it does to home life. And you mentioned something about boomers moving back in. A good example of where you can see that is in Florida today, where there are more people over the age of 85 leaving Florida than there are going in. And the reason is they're outliving their income. And when you outlive your income, some of the people listening to this program might remember when they were young and broke, where do you go? Well, you go back home. You go back to live with or near your family under their care. In fact, one of the fastest growing rates of real estate conversion, residential real estate conversion in the city where I live in New York City, is people turning multifamily dwellings into multi-generational dwellings so that the family can move in, so that grandma can move in, so that mom can move in. A woman born in 1972 or later is almost statistically guaranteed in this country to take care of her mother longer than her mother took care of her, largely as a byproduct of these forces, and they're going to be exacerbated by the fact that our healthcare system is looking at this huge generation of older folks and seeing dollar signs in their eyes and saying, if we can create medications that can extend this generation's lifespan by 10 or 15 years, well, chances are these folks would rather pay for a pill than die. So let's give them a pill that's going to help them live a little bit longer. And that's going to exacerbate all the other forces that we've just been talking about.
Well, you talked about people living longer and older in the U.S. What about around the world? You show a fascinating chart of where the biggest cities are going to be down the road, where people are moving to, where they're living and where they're building.
That's right. If you look at a chart of the world's largest cities in 1980 and 1990, 2000 and 2010. Just take the top 30 or so. What you'll discover is something amazing. New York City stays near the top, but actually comes down a little bit during that period of time. Places like Osaka, Japan, and London, and Paris actually fall dramatically. In fact, London may fall off the list entirely of the world's largest cities. Now, for the first time in human history, and for the foreseeable future, more people live in cities than not. We're becoming and entering now the real urban century. Many of the cities on the list in 2040 and 2050 are in China and haven't been built yet. That's absolutely amazing. So we're talking about instant urbanization. I mean, hyper-urbanization, massive growth. China, in particular, is hyper-urbanizing. So how we balance wealth and our resources and distributing those that wealth around the planet is going to be a real challenge for us.
Well, and let's talk about that because obviously people are talking about the impact on global warming if countries like China and India insist on having the same use of energy as the U.S. and, you know, Britain have had for years. But there are dire predictions. The world is going to run out of potable water. Freshwater scarcity may be one of the major factors limiting development in the years ahead. Literally running out of water. I mean, water tables dropping precipitously.
And it's not just the development issues. There are going to be 3 billion people on planet Earth living in urban slums potentially by the middle of the century. If you want to understand what an urban slum looks like, you have to go to places like India, urban India, where you can see outside of Mumbai places where there's one working toilet for 1,500 people, where there's no infrastructure to provide clean and potable water. Now, it's not just development, right? All kinds of other things ride on top of that. The healthcare system rides on top of clean water. Conflict deeply rides on top of clean water. What do I mean by that? Water issues even affect the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. If you look at where the Israelis get their water, it's a subtext to that whole issue about national territory and access to resources that continues to exacerbate that issue. And it's going to exacerbate tensions and conflicts around the world. So, now, the good news is we actually may have some technologies that will help us. The bad news is that in the meantime, we're drilling out of the ground what we call fossil water. There's water that it was put under the earth some 400 million years ago in areas where it is not a result of natural recurring reservoirs. It's fossilized in the same way that oil or actual fossils are fossilized. It was put down there a long time ago. And once you take it out, you've taken it out. So we are digging out the basic resources of the planet.
And you say we're depleting these basic resources as our populations are growing and moving to cities where they're going to consume even more of them. But you mentioned the good news, and that is that these demographic changes are spawning new technologies, new ways of doing business. When we come back, we'll hear about playground merry-go-rounds in Africa, where as kids play, they're drilling for water, other things like that. And later in the program, what's the future of Tony Soprano? What was that all about on last night's last show? We'll hear about that. Back after a quick break, here and now. It's Here and Now, and we're back with more from futurist Andrew Zolli. We just heard some of his dire predictions for the next 50 years, a planet filled with city dwellers who consume resources before they can be replenished. But Andrew is an optimist, and he says that new technologies have already been developed to revolutionize the world. We want to hear about them. Andrew, one of the innovations is being used in Africa, where playground merry-go-rounds are actually drilling for water wells. But, you know, it's hard to believe that something like a merry-go-round is going to save the planet.
Yeah, that's right. There are tremendous innovations. They're happening all over the world. Many of them are not happening here in the United States because we're not – you don't solve a problem you can't see. If you've got clean water coming out of the tap, you're not thinking about how to invent technologies to get clean water to come out of the tap. But lots of other people who are in resource-constrained areas are thinking about that. These technologies, some of them are incredibly inventive. The one you referred to, the play pump, is a children's play set. As the children swing around a merry-go-round, they actually actually pump water out of a local aquifer into a gravity-fed well that looks like the water towers on the top of city buildings, that keeps women in the local communities from having to walk, in some cases, miles and miles and miles to pumps to get water for daily use. More interesting, I think, than those kinds of technologies are ones inspired by nature. We call those biomimetic and what we think of as eco-innovation technologies that learn from Mother Nature to bring our human systems into greater balance and resonance with the natural systems around us.
This biomimicry, you talk about Silicon Valley in a panic because they're running out of silicon, but there's a biomimetic, is that how you say it?
Biomimetic.
Biomimetic, yeah. For that. What is that?
There is another creature that makes stuff with silicon at a level of precision that's five times better currently than anything that the group of chip manufacturers can come up with, and that is a ubiquitous marine sponge. If you've ever scuba dived or snorkeled, you've seen these little things waving in the coral reef. The little sponge uses its DNA to wrap around molecules of silicon that it takes out of the seawater to build an incredibly precise lattice around which its body grows. So because we're starting to unlock the tools of nature, which has a many billions of year head start on us in terms of engineering problems and engineering solutions, we're beginning to look at the natural world in a whole new way, and that is as a library of innovation for us to learn from.
You say that companies need to take responsibility for their own waste streams and their product end of life, working product end of life into their, you know, their business plan. For instance, 128 million cell phones a year are thrown out by Americans.
That's right. Think about chemicals, heavy chemicals in the chips and the soldering, the lead soldering on all the little boards that make up your little wireless device. Well, that thing was thrown into a landfill and is still out there somewhere. In Europe, you've seen a whole suite of countries pass take-back laws to require companies at the end of a product's useful life to take back products and deal with their disposal and efficient elimination. And what that's caused in Europe is the creation of products that are designed not for assembly, not for easily putting them together, but for really easily taking them apart. We call it design for disassembly. Nokia developed a cell phone, for instance, that can be taken apart in about a second and a half, completely disassembled, so that you can then separate out the parts that can be easily recycled. So what that's done is it's spurred a whole new wave of innovation and invention for new ways of thinking about how to practice what the environmental thinker Bill McDonough calls cradle-to-cradle innovation, creating a product that goes through its life cycle and then becomes the natural resources for other products that live in the next generation.
And as you write, attaching economic value to that elimination of waste.
That's right. I am absolutely convinced that during this century, someone is going to win the Nobel Prize for solving an environmental problem that also will make them a billionaire or a trillionaire.
That's incentives for companies and perhaps individuals who are entrepreneurial. But you suggest getting rid of the income tax and replacing it with something like an eco-tax. What do you mean by that?
What taxes do is they encourage certain kinds of behavior and they discourage other kinds of behavior. And our current system rewards the accumulation of stuff. It rewards the accumulation of wealth. What we could do is shift to a system where we gradually replace chunks of the income tax with a consumption tax that is specifically related to the cost of the environmental cost of the products that you consume. One of my favorite examples, one of my coworkers has an ongoing vitriolic campaign against Fiji water because the cost of all of the carbon emissions that it took to take that water from Fiji all the way to North America, when the water coming out of the tap here in New York City, where I live, for instance, is probably cleaner than the water that you're getting from over there. But the issue is that there's no eco-tax on that activity. The issue is not whether or not it was flown 4,000 miles away. The issue is, did it have to be flown 4,000 miles away? Listen, you've met me, Robin. I'm a big Italian guy, and I love to eat, and I love imported Italian pasta, and I love Italian truffles, and there's no place those grow outside of Italy, and I can't live in Italy. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, all of this has to allow for that kind of specialization and for people to export those things that are truly special from their places around the world. It's an important part of cultural exchange and economic exchange. But don't make a hamburger 4,000 miles away and ship it here without entailing the environmental cost of doing so.
By the way, when you look into this future with all your charts and everything, I mean, do you see something that would surprise us?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of people making a virtue out of unplugging, being able to turn our cell phones off and unplug from the internet, turning off the systems that govern our connections to everybody else may be the greatest luxury of all.
Andrew Zolli, founder of Z Plus Partners, he advises firms on how to prepare for the future. He's also a fellow with the National Geographic Society. He's actually putting together an institute to study the future of the planet. Andrew, thank you so much.
Oh, it's my great pleasure, Robin.
Okay. Continuing to look ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, was nerve gas the Agent Orange of the 1991 Gulf War? We'll hear that question asked and perhaps answered. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, where are the 39 so-called ghost detainees? That's a question of extraordinary rendition. We'll be back after the news here and now. Support from Robin Young, It's Here and Now. A coalition of human rights groups in Britain is demanding information on 39 people allegedly once held in secret prisons. President Bush has acknowledged the existence of secret prisons, and he's said they're now empty. So where are the 39 so-called ghost detainees? It's known that terror suspects have been captured through a process known as extraordinary rendition, then sent to secret CIA-run prisons or to countries such as Egypt and Syria, where detainees claim they were tortured. The CIA claims it acts in strict accordance with American law, but last week, 25 American CIA agents and one military officer went on trial in Italy for the 2003 abduction of a Muslim cleric. And the human rights watchdog group, the Council of Europe, reported that secret prisons existed on the British island of Diego Garcia, as well as in Poland and Romania. Well, for the latest, we turn to Jerome Taylor. He's a reporter for The Independent of London. Jerome, welcome.
Hi, Robin. How you doing?
I'm fine. What is your feeling, or the feeling of experts that you talk to? Are extraordinary renditions still taking place?
It's very difficult to tell because essentially renditions have moved into a sort of phase two since they were uncovered by journalists and human rights NGOs. So the CIA, if they are carrying them out, is being much more careful about how much information leaks out. One recent conflict which would seem to suggest that they possibly are back on is the recent conflict in January when Ethiopian troops moved into Somalia to remove the Islamic Courts Union, which was an Islamic militia that had started to run that country. And during the sort of 3 weeks or so of fighting, many, many people disappeared. And the head of the Ethiopian state said that he was actually holding a number of nationals. Although he then backtracked about a week later when journalists followed that up.
Mm. Well, let me jump in to ask, isn't it possible that they and maybe the so-called ghost detainees could be in Guantanamo, where President Bush acknowledged 14 other detainees were sent from secret prisons to Guantanamo? As we said, he said the secret prisons are now empty. Or that some of the ghost detainees could be cooperating, perhaps sent to a witness detention program.
Sure. I mean, that's always a possibility. But, I mean, if they remain in Guantanamo and we don't know about them, they are still ghost detainees. And they are still essentially, you know, do not exist. So if they are in Guantanamo, then we should know about that.
And who are they, specifically the 39 ghost detainees? The BBC quotes watch groups saying that among them could be children as young as seven.
That's one possibility, yeah. I mean, essentially, those 39 detainees are interesting because a number of the people are from Africa, others are from Asia. Where they were picked up, we don't necessarily know. Some might have been picked up in the Horn of Africa. Again, some might have been picked up in Asia. I mean, those tend to be the kind of hotspots at the moment where these people are being picked up.
The most famous case, the pieces were put together in the case of the Muslim cleric known as Abu Omar, who was picked up outside his mosque in Milan, Italy, 4 years ago. We covered on the program the trial that started last week in Italy of the U.S. agents who did that. But you wrote about it. Tell us just a little bit about how he was picked up.
Well, it's a fascinating sort of classic snatch operation. A group of between about, the actual snatch group was around about seven people, we think. The people involved seem to be about 12 to 15 people. They monitored him for about 3 weeks, monitored his movements. And as he walked down the street towards the mosque where he was a preacher, they simply picked him up off the street, put him in a van and drove him to a U.S. air base in the north of Italy before rendering him to Egypt.
He claims he was tortured in Egypt. And as you write, officials in Italy were furious because they were already investigating him and the snatch was so secret that even they didn't know.
Mm.
What's the sense as to whether or not rendition works?
Well, I think some renditions obviously do work. I mean, if you look at Ramzi Youssef, who was the man who was behind the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993, I mean, he was actually rendered from Pakistan, where he was arrested, to the U.S. He was rendered, you know, from a country which was very difficult to get him to a country where he could be tried under U.S. law. So sometimes it does work. And Michael Scheuer, who is the former head of the Bin Laden unit at the CIA, has gone on record to talk about how if you want somebody off the street who may be going to commit terror acts against the country, then rendition is one way of sorting it.
But what about the idea of rendition as, you know, a secret way of getting a suspect to a country that might use harsh interrogation methods? Is there a sense that, you know, rendition works for those kinds of intelligence gathering?
No, I think when you talk to people, most people within the intelligence community are extremely uncomfortable about the idea that of sending somebody to a third-party country with a track record of torture, because it simply provides bad intelligence. The fact of the matter is, if you torture somebody, they will tell you what they think you want to hear.
Well, and that brings us to the Council of Europe report this past Friday, which talks about the Pacific island of Diego Garcia. It's owned by Britain, but leased to America. Mm. And there's a claim from the report that it's a site for a CIA secret prison with documentation of flights, CIA flights going in and out of the island.
Mm.
What does that tell people about, you know, whether or not secret prisons are active?
Well, it shows that essentially these prisons are active and that essentially the CIA is getting better at hiding them. One of the suggestions is that a good place to essentially ghost away prisoners would be on a civilian container ship that would be sort of leased, secretly leased through shell companies.
But there are people who, and we just want to quickly make sure we cover this, there are people who question the Council of Europe report. How credible is it?
The Council of Europe report is pretty credible. The difficulty is, you know, you're not going to have a European government admitting to colluding with the U.S., but Dick Marty, the special rapporteur in charge of the Council of Europe report, this is his second report now. The significance of this report is that he claims to have interviewed a large number of people in the intelligence community who were becoming increasingly unhappy about the way this paramilitary side to the war on terror was being carried out.
In fact, one is quoted as saying he worries about the relationships with intelligence forces in other countries. He feels renditions have been like a bull in a china shop, I think is the phrase that was used.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, one CIA officer I spoke to who had a good knowledge of renditions, although officially the CIA still doesn't even admit whether renditions take place or not. But his concern was essentially that it can lead to a huge amount of distrust between the intelligence agencies of various countries, and that actually in the war on terror you need more cooperation than ever before. So, you know, these snatches can cause a large amount of both in intelligence difficulties and diplomatic problems as well between countries that actually need each other in a time of heightened security.
Jerome Taylor, correspondent for The Independent of London. Jerome, thanks so much.
Thanks very much for letting me on the show.
Later in the show, music inspired by a man who fell into a coma and lived to tell the tale, however tentatively. You're listening to Here and Now. Last night saw the final scene of HBO's hit series, The Sopranos. Tony sits down in a booth at the diner. His wife, Carmela, arrives.
You talk to Mink again?
It's Carlo. He's going to testify.
You know, just the usual family business. Tony looks up each time the door opens to what? A potential assassin? Or his son, AJ? Hey, who's that guy walking in front of AJ? And why is daughter Meadow having trouble parking? Oh no, maybe she's going to just miss the impending mob hit. And then... Don't stop. What? Cut to black? What was creator David Chase thinking? Bob Thompson is television and popular culture professor at Syracuse University. Bob, did you feel robbed?
I was really disappointed, but at the same time, I remember the first time I read T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, I was really disappointed. I had no idea what it meant. This is going to be one of those episodes I think we got to go back, watch a couple more times. But yes, my initial response was, that's it. What happens to Tony Soprano is he listens to some Journey and he orders dinner.
Journey, of course, the rock group. We're left with not knowing in that last moment, those who didn't see it, Tony Soprano's face. He looks up. We don't know if the guy who got up to go to the bathroom, maybe a la The Godfather,
has
come out with his guns blazing. We don't know if he looks up to greet his daughter, who for some weird reason had trouble parking, so she's running into the restaurant at the last second, maybe to see her family gunned down. For several agonizing moments, you know, it's just his face, and we think we're going to see in the next image what happens. Instead, it cuts right to black. And in that moment, you know, all of America, it would seem, is saying, you know, what? Picking up their remotes, trying to figure out if they lost power. Is that sort of a joke on the viewers?
They certainly messed with our head, especially going back outside to the daughter parking. But here's my interpretation. Very first episode of The Sopranos, Tony is talking to the psychiatrist, and he says, you know, it's good to get in on things at the beginning. It feels like I've come to this too late. The glory days are over. This whole thing has been about the fact that Tony Soprano wants to be Don Corleone, but he was born too late, and he's paranoid that people see him instead as Homer Simpson. He's got a real kind of identity crisis, and He doesn't get, at the end, the big mob ending. Every great mobster in the old days used to get a big death scene. He gets no blaze of glory. He doesn't even get a fade to black. And maybe the perfect ending for the tragedy of this story about a guy who wants to be Don Corleone in an age after Don Corleone is that you just simply leave him there having dinner, listening to a song that you might argue isn't even that great of a song to go out on.
You might, but then you'd hear from Journey fans. That's Bob Thompson, a television and popular culture professor at Syracuse University, by the way. Soprano Sound came to us courtesy of HBO. Well, we want to turn now to Susie Q. She's the events manager for the Satin Doll. Now, that was the setting for the Bada Bing strip club in the show. In the back rooms, Tony runs his operation, and in the front rooms, hoo boy. Susie Q, were people there watching?
Oh, yeah, we had standing room only. We had 200 people plus here last night.
What'd they think? What'd people think?
Boy, there was a gasp for air and dead silence when that screen went blank, and everybody thought that we lost power, and I did too, as a matter of fact, so I was a little nervous there. And then when it came time for the credits, we had people mad, leaving, yelling at us. I said, hey, I didn't write it. You know, people were mad last night.
Did people feel that suddenly what maybe had been, as Bob Thompson was saying, a little bit of glory, sort of became this diminished, sort of unsatisfying...
I think people seemed a little unsettled last night, but I have to be honest, a major portion of our customers were happy in the parking lot thinking, now the Sopranos may come back with a film. Honestly, we don't know how that was progressed, how old Meadow or AJ was there, and we don't know what diner they were in. They could all be in another state for all we know and come back, and he could be in another state eating in another diner with his family completely reconnected.
Well, and Susie Q, I just want to say, they were hanging out in the parking lot after what happened in that parking lot to Sill?
Yeah, we had 200 people here, yep. They were outside in the lot. Yep.
Be careful. Susie Q is events manager at the Satin Doll, the setting for the Bada Bing Gentlemen's Club in The Sopranos. Susie Q, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Why do I get the feeling it's not over yet? Well, after a quick break, music that can come after a stroke. That's next Here and Now. Oh, Robin Young, It's Here and Now. Dan Mountain was a successful advertising copywriter in Venice, California, with a thriving career and a fistful of awards, when at the age of 58, he had a stroke and fell into a coma. After 3 weeks, doctors told his wife there was no hope, so she chose to take Dan off life support and bring him home to die. But yes, this is one of those stories. Hours after support was removed, Dan Mountain woke up and haltingly began to speak. His longtime friend, musician Mark Black, heard poetry in Dan's tentative speech and set Dan's words to music. The resulting CD is called Stroke of Genius, which, by the way, is also the name of a documentary on Dan's life. The CD features Mark's friends from the music world, including Art Garfunkel, John Sebastian, and the gospel group The Dixie Hummingbirds. You hear them on this song, Let 'Em Go.
The hour has come, the time is nigh. No hesitation, no reason why. Why should we try? The hour has come, the time is nigh. The train is at the station. You've got to know, it's time to let go.
And joining us from Cotoni, New York is Mark Black. Welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
And from the hospital in Venice, California, where he's unfortunately had to have a little bit of treatment, we welcome Dan Mountain. Dan, welcome to you as well.
Okay.
I want to start with you, Dan. Do you remember being in a coma?
No. Every once in a while, I think there were feelings that I don't even know that they were advanced enough to call them thoughts. But meaning more than anything, I wasn't dead in there. There was stuff going on. I've never really discovered what it is. I'm not even sure I have to or want to.
How would you characterize yourself now?
Well, I'm back big time in a lot of ways. And I'm into life again, first of all, and I'm in a very positive mood these days.
Right.
The one good thing about a stroke is if you survive it all, you're probably going to get better, and everyone else is going to get worse. So there's that little...
What do you mean everybody else is going to get worse?
Well, no, I'm just, you know, with age. You know,
oh, right, right, right. So you're on a very different continuum once you come out of the... I get
and
it.
And the reason is because I was so far down, I would know where to go but up or out.
All right. Well, and lucky for you, also in your case, you came out with some incredible words. I want to bring Mark in here. Mark, we've read that the first time you saw Dan after a stroke, you saw, you know, to your mind, he had obviously had a rough go in the stroke. But he what happened when he spoke to you?
He had no idea you were there. It was not like just his left side was damaged. It wasn't there. And so he was this fragment of what he had been. And yet he said these things that, and I don't remember right now what they were, but I turned to his wife, Dorothy, and I said, we have to write some of this stuff down.
Well, some of his words soon became music. Let's listen to the song, When You Get Back.
When you get back, never get back to where you've been. Always get back to where you're going. Down the line.
Dan, do you remember speaking those words? When you get back, you never get back to where you've been.
Actually, I did. I do.
You do. What were you? What did you mean?
That you must get on with life because life gets on. And if you stand still, you go backwards. So you have to go forward. You have no choice. That's the majesty of it, in a way.
Basically, Dan came out of the coma with kind of boundless gratitude for life and an appreciation for life that everybody around him felt.
And you know what? It's made all the difference for me and my wife, because we are so much better off as people now than we were a few years ago.
Really? Before your stroke?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there were things that we are sorry that we had to give up forever, and there are actually many of those. But, like, it's the beginning of the next phase of our life, and we're going to get better and better and better.
When you say you had to give some things up, I mean, do you mean, you know, obviously the fast-paced advertising world? Is that the kind of thing you mean, or?
Yeah. That was,
You were looking for a way to get out.
Huh. Yeah. I just thought I'd do it a lot more easily than the way I ended up using.
I want to listen to a little more of the music. This is called These Days. Again, words by Dan Mountain, music by Mark Black, with an assist from Art Garfunkel. Let's listen.
Not quite here. Not quite forgotten. In a world of their own. Not quite forgotten. And we in a new one try surviving.
Mark Black, I just want to ask you about that, because do I understand that you were in the 1967 group Blades of Grass, who, of course, had the hit Happy?
Yes.
Can you hum a little of that? Can you?
Happy is the day I found you. Happy is the world around you.
That's right.
I never said as long as
Wow, you remember that?
Oh, vaguely. I know you've been doing music since then in many different ways, in sessions and, you know, for advertising, but it just strikes me that this is, in a funny way, kind of a rebirth for you as well.
I don't know if it was so much a rebirth, but just to have Dan open up to me like this, there was so much tenderness and so much vulnerability. And as a songwriter, to be able to use my skills to take his beautiful sentiments and just kind of bring them to life was a great honor. And professionally, it was a great deal for me.
The part of the thing about this adventure for us is that no one has ever really tried to do what we are doing with music, and music and the idea of Strokes and all of that kind of stuff, and it's about time. And if you do it as well as I think we have done it, you really get to make it to the next level, which is not about a physical thing at all, but something metaphysical and above it all.
Dan Mountain, whose life after stroke is captured in the documentary Stroke of Genius, and the CD of the same name, he wrote the lyrics and Mark Black did the music. Mark and Dan, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
It's good to be alive. I'm very grateful for this second chance, and this has been a really important part of it.
A new day, another season, new machine, I got another chance. Better time, new romance to dance our way back home.
That's Our Way Back from the Stroke of Genius CD. For more, you can go to our website, here-now.org. And remember, you can download a podcast of any show while there. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.